5738, and thank you so much.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
It is 5 p.m. Thursday, and it's time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, producer and tonight's host, and every week, with help from the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on journeys through windows of their souls. Before we get started, please forgive my voice tonight. It's raspy. I might even make less sense than I usually do. Today's stories offer a tough thread. Children expressing pain, suffering, even loss. Depressing? Well, you might think so, but research uncovers something different. Children's voices chime in on what they need better than most adults. A good example of this was this show on January 22nd. When a New York theater ensemble reenacted a play written by playwright Minette Greenberg called Eva's Tale, commemorating Holocaust Remembrance Day. Eva, a Holocaust survivor, is alive and well at 98 and indeed has an astonishing story to tell. But her story, however, emerged in her childhood, in hiding, awaiting death or life or something. Not unlike Anne Frank, Eva and thousands of other children chronicled their lives in hiding, or as refugees, or moments before they perished. Children communicating unimaginable fears to us, to each other. History is flooded with these sorts of cases, and one was covered on this show that day. Before all-out war broke out, the Nazis made plans to deceive the International Red Cross inspectors into believing that Jews were being treated humanely. To accomplish this, when the Red Cross came through the camp, inmates were encouraged to take up creative activities. They were given instruments and art supplies, encouraged to hold concerts. Within the camp, parks, grassy areas and flower beds, concert venues, statues, were installed to hide the truth. Considered by many historians as one of the best examples of Nazi propaganda. But the truth of what was really happening at the camp was conveyed through art and words, and ultimately the truth about Theresienstadt and all the camps. It was disseminated into the free world by the underground. Sadly, after the Red Cross left, most of the children who helped fool the Red Cross were immediately sent to Auschwitz. The collection of works of art and poetry by Jewish children who lived in Theresien is in I Never Saw a Butterfly. The book takes its title from a poem by Pavel Friedman, one of the inmates. The very last, so richly, brightly dazzling yellow. Perhaps if the sun's tears would sing against a white stone. Such a yellow is carried lightly, way up high. It went away, I'm sure, because it wished to kiss the world goodbye. For 7 weeks I've lived here, penned up inside this ghetto. But I have found my people here. The dandelions call to me, and the white chestnut candles in the court. Only I never saw another butterfly. That butterfly was the last one. Butterflies don't live in here, here in the ghetto. Using a metaphor so effectively isn't something we expect at a time of crisis. Most of us would be hard-pressed to craft such literary symbolism without any pressure at all. In Children in the Holocaust, their secret diaries, compiled by Laurel Holiday, the familiar tone that laces the diary of Anne Frank is left in hundreds of narratives by children confronted by fears and desperation for survival. An 11-year-old boy at Treblinka death camp writes, "I was so cold, I slept under a corpse. During the night, of course. I didn't realize it. It was very cold, and I curled up against someone's back. I slipped my hands under her armpits. I thought she moved, and in the morning, I discovered she was dead." The boy had no defined audience for his words. His letter had "Thoughts to Me" written at the top of the page. Reflections from children, introspections, epiphanies, each positioned as in story form. As a communication professor of more than 40 years, I've always been interested in ways children use expression, and stories in particular, to address debilitating feelings to ultimately heal. Parents sometimes tell stories which send messages designed to drown feelings of anguish, despair, grief, just to name a few, of their children. Sure, it's done out of love to protect them from the painful realities of life, but here's the thing. Kids are smart, and when they dig deep, a different kind of rawness emerges. It's a freshness we call authenticity. I became interested in difficult stories told by children when my beagle, Sadie, was trained as a therapy dog. For several Christmases, she and I would visit pediatric wards in the city, along with the other furry creatures of love, and that's exactly what they were. Each dog represented everything we expect from love. It's probably best if I give you an image of Sadie, so here it is. It's a story that I told at the Moth a few years ago. The theme was love hurts. Japanese researchers claim that if you stare into a dog's eyes, the hormone oxytocin is going to kick in, the love hormone, cuddle hormone. Now, those of you who are dog lovers, how many of you are there, right? Yeah, for those of you who are not, you know, you can say death penalty, can't you? Okay, good. That's how I felt about my first dog, and she meant everything to me. She really did, because I was going through a terrible time in my life, and she was there at the right moment. Her name was Sadie, a beagle, and she won the lottery because when she came back to my apartment, she looked around and saw a king-size Tempur-Pedic and said, "That's going to be mine." Then she used to look at the pantry for hours, thinking treats will be manifesting from this any moment now. And if you know beagles, you know all they do is eat, right? I mean, if my apartment was robbed, she'd look at the two burglars and say, "Look, you give me a cookie, I'll show her where the silver is." But her gaze was everything. Those researchers were right. I was stopped at Montrose and Richmond, and there was some traffic, and everybody was looking at a gentleman in a car. And I looked over there, and it was a gentleman who had been badly burned. He was terribly disfigured. And as he was looking around, everybody else was looking away. But he was looking in my car. Actually, he was looking at Sadie in the back seat as she had her head out the window, looking at this gentleman, seeing no difference. He wasn't disfigured to her. He was smiling. They made each other's day. She was a therapy dog at MD Anderson. She could cure anyone with a touch and a smile. A couple of months shy of her 16th birthday, she was riddled with cancer, and we had to put her down. And
I'm not going to tell you what you don't already know. You know how painful that is. I can't possibly describe the pain, but the vet, who was pretty magnificent, explained to me what I would be experiencing because I was holding her. And just like she had done all of those years looking at others, she looked at me and she said, "Thank you for my life." So I held her and my heart dropped to my stomach and stayed there as she left. And then I got in my car, going back to my apartment. I was terrified looking back. I didn't want to see the back seat where she was seated. So about 20 minutes later, I'm driving into my apartment. And as I drive into my apartment, there's the mailboxes on the left. It was early Saturday morning. There wasn't any reason for me to look at those mailboxes. No reason at all. I've never done it before, but I did instinctively. I looked to the mailboxes, and there was a young man about 35 years old wearing sunglasses. And as I looked at him and he looked at me, he smiled. And he was walking two beagle puppies. I felt great at that moment. I went to the manager when the management opens up a little bit later, and I asked, "Who is that guy?" I described him, and they said, "I don't know who you're talking about. There is anybody here who looks like him?" I said, "You got to be kidding." He was wearing sunglasses, about 35 years old, dark hair, black T-shirt, walking two beagle puppies. And the manager said, "Hank, you know, there are no beagle puppies that live here. None that you're describing." And I'm thinking, nobody's going to believe this. So I talked to my wife, who's the smartest person I know, and I said, "You know, you're a spiritual person and I'm not. What do you think of this episode?" And she said, "It's a message. It's definitely a message." And I said, "You know, I never experienced one like this before. It was the most spiritual moment that I ever experienced, short of watching my son born." So I thought about that, and the man was not JD reincarnated, don't worry about it, although they did have the same coloring. But nevertheless, I thought about that, and what I thought was that, you know, death ends a life, but it doesn't end a relationship. And then I remembered what Dr. Seuss always said, which is, "Don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened." And she did happen, even though it ended, and she will forever be loved and lodged very deeply in my heart. Peace.
It's one of the most spiritual relationships I ever had. Fortunately, every dog I ever had or have owns my heart, and each. Sadie's sister, at the time, a mini dachshund named Hannah, and my current long-haired best buddy, a long-haired chihuahua named Simon, who's probably listening to the show right now because he knows it would make me happy. They each taught me so much. Sadie was responsible for showing me the magic of a child's palette of expression. In the book, Bunnies in My Head, award-winning author Tricia Tusa wraps her storyline around the watercolor artwork of many of the young cancer patients at MD Anderson. The artwork created by these astounding children is her backdrop. The story, the words, the cadence, plot, character development, the conflict, all came from the mouth of babes. Tricia just wrote what they said. I'm going to read it to you. I wish I could show you the pictures, but if you love a good story, and you know the power of radio, you'll be able to paint these pictures in your mind. Bunnies in My Head. This is to the children of MD Anderson, who soar above adversity with courage and their creative imaginations. Their valor is inspiration to us all. I've got bunnies in my head, white and silent, as big as mountains, in search of carrots, as big as trees. I like to paint trees, cold ones out in the snow, and fancy ones at Christmas time. Trees that tower over me, like the buildings downtown. With my brush and crayons, I can show you another world, different from this one we live in. a world far away and inside my head. One where orange, furry things roam wearing socks. This is my cat, Millie. She's as dark as midnight. Millie pounces on her own tail as if she was captured a prize. She bats at butterflies in the garden. A fuzzy one turned out to be a moth and changed my sweater into Swiss cheese. This is our garden. I think all the flowers from my favorite nightgown faded off back here. All the colors and lights and shapes bump into one another and wakes us up early. This is my house with a fence in front and a squirrel up above. What if I live in a tall, skinny house that swayed back and forth on purple stilts with a rainbow overhead? There would be a circus underneath with a trapeze and a dancing polar bear and carnival rides. You could roll on far into the night. I can tell you anything with my paintbrush. When my head feels as jumbled as that, or as still as this. Or even at bedtime when my mom turns out the light and I feel scared, I remember my crayons. I think when I hold them, I sprout wings in my sleep and am free to fly around the world and stars. I wonder what will show up next. A bunny? A round pink one with happy green eyes? I can tell you all about them. The story not only highlights the artwork and words of children with cancer, some terminal, it highlights their heroic spirits and the power of imagination. For me, these children and service dogs like Sadie manifest from the same heart, the same soul. Remember, I've got bunnies in my head, explains a charming little girl, as big as mountains, in search of carrots, as big as the trees. A fanciful journey into the unknown, literally not knowing about tomorrow or if there will be one. But in my mind, reflects the little girl, there will always be tomorrow. No one can stop me. One winter morning in 1990, I tuned into the Today Show and was transfixed to a story being told by parents expressing a kind of love for a child rarely shared in public. Their son, David, was a double major in art and English at Yale when he received unthinkable news. He was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. He hadn't long to live. In the words of his mother, David told us that just like the scarecrow had a brain all along, the tin man a heart, and the cowardly lion courage, that he would find strength he never thought he had to deal with the pain that overwhelmed him and his parents, that he wouldn't let physical or emotional pain control him. It was in the middle of a book entitled "The Jester Has Lost His Jingle," explained his father. An assignment of sorts for a senior thesis. He decided to complete the book. His mother, juggling tears with a subtle smile, said he decided to change the plot of the book and keep the title, something he wanted to say that was more useful for children and adults, but mostly kids, to find the courage to gather their paralyzing thoughts about death and to communicate them in ways so bold that you live forever in the mind of those who hear them, who see them, and who live them. David died 3 months after finishing the book. His father was unable to hide his anger when reporting to the world that no one would publish it. So we, his father asserted, his mother and I, took our savings, all of it, and we published it. The gesture awakes to find laughter missing in the kingdom, and he and his friend Farley, a little stick man, set off on a quest to find it. Radio, as I referred to earlier, is about creating internal imagery, so envision a jester, a little stick man, and how they interact with very familiar characters in the story. The Jester Has Lost His Jingle by David Saltzman. The story begins quite removed in a castle far away. Our story unfolds, unfortunately, on a very unfortunate day. You see, this morning when the world awoke, no one was in any mood to joke. But one was still happy and bubbled with joy, for he played with life as you play with a toy. He would dance to its rhythm, being light on his feet. He would sing to its tune, which was gentle and sweet, for he was the jester. And gesture would be to make people laugh and fill them with glee. And he had a special helper, as any jester should, a friend by name of Farley, a piece of talking wood. He carried Farley all over. The two were quite a pair. They viewed life as a carnival, a fun-filled, festive fair. But today, when the jester broke out in his song, how could he have known that something was wrong? When he started his routine and strutted on the stage, how could he have known that the king was in a rage? So he sang his funny song and he walked his funny walk. He danced his funny dance and he talked his funny talk. But nobody giggled and nobody yucked. Nobody laughed and nobody chucked. The jester has lost his jingle, the king yelled in dismay. His bells no longer tingle. That's all I have to say. Then without a thought and on a whim, the king decided to banish him. Banish me, sire? Don't send me away. Why is your highness so down on this fine day? But the king gave no answer. He said nothing more, merely pointed his finger toward the front door. The jester walked out slowly, and a tear fell from his face. For he'd never left the kingdom, never wandered from this place. And once outside, the jester cried, "Oh, Farley, I fear what they say is quite true. I'm no longer funny. My career is quite through." "That's nonsense," claimed Farley. "You're still funny, I say. You were funny last week, and you're funny today. It seems a nasty rumor, but laughter must be dead. The world has lost its sense of humor," Farley sadly said. "Then it isn't true. For me at all. It's the world that must be sick. It must be that humor. It must be there for me to fall and find it quick." So off they went, our fearless two, to bring back laughter back to you. The journey was long and their journey was rough, but the jester was strong and the jester was tough. They looked far and wide. They looked everywhere that laughter might hide. They searched in every corner, under rocks and up in trees. They peered into the heavens and gazed deep beneath the seas. They wandered through the country, through meadows lush and pretty. They came upon a gleaming bridge that led into a city. They looked in vain for flowers. They heard no songs of birds, but saw lots of angry faces and heard lots of bitter words. "Everyone here is so moody. Everyone here is so mean. I must confess this city is the saddest place I've ever seen. Maybe someone here can tell me. Maybe someone here might know. How come people aren't laughing? How come spirits are so low?" "Ask that man," Farley motioned. "That man over there. The thin one in the alley with the tangles in his hair." "Okay," said the jester, "I'll give it a go." "Why are you not laughing, sir? I'd really like to know." "It's kind of hard to laugh or joke when you're unemployed and completely broke. I have no job. I have no money. So tell me, jester, what would be so funny?" Oh, Farley, I fear it's much worse than I thought. Is laughter something that people forgot? Impossible, cried Farley. Why, that's news I couldn't bear. Ask that man with the briefcase blowing smoke in the air. Okay, said the jester. I'll try another try. It seems you don't believe in laughing, sir. Can you please tell me why? Laugh! That's a laugh. That's the best I've had in years. The world is not a funny place. It's filled with pain and tears. Don't you read the papers? It's all there in black and white. Everything is going wrong, and jokes just won't make it right. I have no time for laughter. I have no time for you. I'm sorry that's the way things are. There's nothing you can do. Don't believe him, Farley. We know we must be wrong. He must be wrong. Our search for laughter must continue. Time to move along. The jester looked up to the sky, and he let out a woeful sigh. He fought back tears and shook his head, then with determination said, there must be someone somewhere with a smile upon their face. There must be someone cheerful in this cold and lonely place. Say, look at that tall building. Perhaps we'll find the answer there. It's up to us to make a difference. It's up to us to care. What of her? What about her? Asked Farley. That little girl in bed, the one who looks so fragile, with the bandage on her head. Hello, little girl, the jester said. My, how do you do? I wonder if you can tell me how come laughter is not with you. The little girl looked up and her eyes were wide open. She turned slowly to the jester and she quietly replied, here I lie. I have a tumor. And you ask me where's my sense of humor? I've been very sick. And I'm so tired of trying. I don't feel like laughing. I just feel like crying. Sometimes I feel like crying too, the jester whispered in her ear. But instead of letting teardrops fall, I make them disappear. Whenever I feel like crying, I smile hard instead. I turn my sadness upside down and stand it on its head. When I get sad or lonesome, or when I get depressed, that's when I sing my loudest and dance my very best. So won't you try, little girl? Won't you laugh with me? We'll start off very slowly with a tiny tee. And he sang his funny song, and he walked his funny walk, and he danced his funny dance, and he talked his funny talk. And from the room, there came a giggle, which echoed down the halls. And soon there came another, which bounced up and down the walls. The giggle became a snicker, which grew into a guffaw, which soon became a chuckle and transformed into a ha-ha. The jester was beside himself. He grinned a great big grin. He hugged and thanked the little girl and kissed her on the chin. Soon, laughter leaped right out of the window, growing louder as it flew. Can't you hear it coming? It's about to swallow you. It spread to every corner. It filled up every space. Smiles popped up everywhere. Can't you feel one on your face? And the jester ran back to the kingdom. He carried rainbows in his hand, and the people started laughing. Color spread across the land. He leaped into the palace, and he hugged the king and queen. He said, oh, my highness, you won't believe what I have seen. Laughter isn't missing. Why, it isn't even dead. Farley and I have found it, the jester proudly said. We found it where it's been hiding. We've discovered where it's been. It's hiding inside everyone. It's buried deep within. Laughter's like a seedling, waiting patiently to sprout. And it takes is just a push to make it pop right out. Don't be imprisoned or locked out of sight. Quietly release it. It won't hurt or bite. So the king said, I'll try it. I'll give it a go. And all of a sudden, out popped a ho-ho-ho-ho. That's it, yelled the jester. Just let it flow. And it flowed, and it flowed, and it flowed. And soon, everybody started giggling. Everybody started yuckling. Everybody started laughing. Everybody started chuckling. My jester, you have done it, said the king. You've saved the day. You've brought back love and laughter and helped us find the way. And when the jester heard those words, he smiled and started singing. He somersaulted in the air, for his bells again were ringing. And so when you're feeling lonely or sad or bad or blue, remember where laughter is hiding. It's hiding inside of you. It's always hard for me to get through that story. You know, David didn't wait for death. He barked at death. You think you're an obstacle? I have strength I never thought possible. I'm the jester. Go ahead. Sing your funny song, walk your funny walk, dance your funny tune, talk your funny talk, but sometimes it's okay not to laugh. The Jester Has Lost His Jingle. Picture and story by David Saltzman. The Jester Company, Inc., P.O. Box 817, Malaga Cove Plaza, Verdes Estates, California, 90274. I'm going to have that info on our Facebook page. I am Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story? Only on Houston's Community Station, KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. I got to tell you, H-Town is Storytown. Let's start with the show's proud sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. It's a terrific place to tell stories and meet the nicest, most supportive people around. Trust me, I'm their president. They meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30. So visit their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link to all their story swaps and for information about upcoming events like our famous, and I do mean famous, Liars Contest held on April 30th. This is a big event. Now make that huge. It's more fun than the law allows, but you need to register and again do so by going to www.houstonstorytellers.org for a fun night. It's a great date night, too. As a matter of fact, so much fun, she may even want to go out with you again. I don't know. Speaking of date nights, our friends at The Moth is back at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific narratives on a focus theme and meet what I think you're going to find to be a surprising number of like-minded storytellers in Houston. And make sure you're vaccinated, or they're not going to let you in. Good for them, right? The Tejas Storytelling Association just ended another magical festival that showcased some of the best tellers you'll hear anywhere. So why not take your skills to the next level by becoming a member of Tejas? Just go to TejasStorytelling.com and the National Storytelling Network, which taps into storytellers not only around the country, but around the world. Please visit us, by the way, on So What's Your Story at facebook.com/So What's Your Story, and let us know if you have guests that we ought to consider. Or please text me, Hank, H-A-N-K, 832-277-1581. That's 832-277-1581. You know, many parents of elementary and middle school children know about Amelia's Notebook, Amelia Bedelia. It's a series of children's books written and illustrated by Marissa Moss. The books targeted at children between 9 and 11 are a series of notebooks and journals written by the character Amelia, who writes about her life, thoughts, and memories. They are profusely illustrated and designed to resemble actual journals. Amelia is a character with whom lots of kids identify. She has problems like gossip, moving, crushes. Amelia has also written guides such as Dr. Amelia's Boredom Survival Guide, Amelia's Guide to Gossip, her Bully Survival Guide, an Easy to Draw Guide, a step-by-step guide on how to draw, which is a really good one because she talks about her feelings when her parents are going through a divorce. The kinds of problems that all of our children feel, and they need an opportunity to communicate their feelings about them. The series Help Encourage Journaling, which is an effective first step for children, harnessing the courage to engage in difficult conversations. And by the way, remember this, Alexander and the No Good, Very Bad Day.
Terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Written by Judith Voigt, illustrated by Ray Cruz. I went to sleep with gum in my mouth, and now there's gum in my hair. When I got out of bed this morning, I tripped on the skateboard, and by mistake, I dropped my sweater in the sink while the water was running, and I could tell. It was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. At breakfast, Anthony found a Corvette Stingray car kit in his breakfast cereal box, and Nick found a Junior Undercover Agent code ring in his breakfast cereal box. But in my breakfast cereal box, all I found was breakfast cereal. I think I'll move to Australia. In the carpool, Miss Gibson let Becky have a seat by the window. Audrey and Elliot got seats by the window, too. I said I was being scrunched. I said I was being smushed. I said if I don't get a seat by the window, I'm going to be car sick. No one even answered. I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. At school, Miss Dickens liked Paul's picture of the sailboat better than my picture of the invisible castle. At singing time, she said I sang too loud. At counting time, she said I left out 16. Who needs 16? I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. I could tell because Paul said I wasn't his best friend anymore. He said that Philip Parker was his best friend and that Albert Moyo was his next best friend and that I was only his third best friend. I hope you sit on a tack, I said to Paul. I hope the next time you get a double-decker strawberry ice cream cone, the ice cream part falls off the cone part and lands in Australia. There were two cupcakes in Philip Parker's lunch bag, and Albert got a Hershey bar with almonds, and Paul's mother gave him a piece of jelly roll that had little coconut sprinkles on the top. Guess whose mother forgot to put in dessert. It was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. That's what it was, because after school, my mom took us all to the dentist, and Dr. Fields found a cavity just in me. Come back next week and I'll fix it, said Dr. Fields. Next week, I said, I'm going to Australia. On the way downstairs, the elevator door closed on my foot. And while we were waiting for my mom to get the car, Anthony made me fall where it was muddy. And then I started crying because of the mud. Nick said I was a crybaby. And while I was punching Nick for saying crybaby, my mom came back to the car and scolded me for being muddy and fighting. I'm having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, I told everybody. No one even answered. So then we went to the shoe store to buy some sneakers. Anthony chose white ones with blue stripes. Nick chose red ones with white stripes. I chose blue ones with red stripes. But then the shoe man said, "We're all sold out." They made me buy plain old white ones. But they can't make me wear them. When we picked up my dad at his office, he said I couldn't play with his copying machine, but I forgot. He also said to watch out for the books on his desk, and I was careful as could be, except for my elbow. He also said
Okay, well, you're getting the idea. For those of you who never heard of that story or never read it, I don't know where you've been, but you get the general idea, right? Okay, he ends up realizing that it's been an awful day, and he tells his mother, and his mother says, yeah, some days are like that, even in Australia. I think you're all catching the trend here, right? Great story. Alexander and the Horrible, Terrible, Very Bad Day by writer and psychoanalyst Judith Viorst. A must-read for, well, everyone. Danish poet, author, and storyteller incarnate Hans Christian Andersen was ahead of his time. Many of his stories were inspired only when thinking like a child. Our current world treats subjects like bullying and diversity like they're new, somehow profound, unique. It's a good chance people who think this way never read The Ugly Duckling. You know, the story begins with the eggs of a mother duck hatching. Baby ducklings emerge from their shells, and one of them looks different from the rest. The other ducklings and animals on the farm make fun of him because he's an ugly duckling, and he runs away from home. Now, all alone and wandering aimlessly through the wilderness, he catches sight of a group of swans. As they fly away, he thinks to himself, they are so beautiful. However, he could not join them because he was too young and couldn't fly. Time passes, and eventually the duckling grows larger. However, he's still sad. Later, he catches sight of those swans again. He wanted to join them so badly, but he thought that they would reject him. I'm just too ugly, the duckling cried. The swans hear him crying. So they go over to see what's wrong. After examining him for a moment, they welcome him as one of their own. This was very surprising to the duckling. Why would they do that? It was then that he saw his reflection in the water. Why? He wasn't an ugly duckling after all. He was, in fact, a beautiful swan. You know what? 2 weeks ago, I talked about the story song. So how about one of the most prolific American storytellers sing a little ditty for Lars, a little boy who's afraid that others will laugh at him because a serious disease caused him to lose his hair. Here's The Ugly Duckling told by Danny Kaye as Hans Christian Andersen.
What's the matter? Are you unhappy? Would you like me to tell you a special story? You would? Well, come on up here. Come on. Come here, you can walk a little faster.
Once was an ugly duckling with feathers all stubby and brown. And the other birds, in so many words, said, get out of town. Get out, get out, get out of town. And he went with a quack and a waddle and a quack and a flurry of eiderdown.
Would you like me to tell you the rest of the story? All
right. That poor little ugly duckling went wandering far and near. But at every place they said to his face, now get out of here. Get out, get out, get out of here. And he went with a quack and a waddle and a quack and a very unhappy tear. All through the winter time he hid himself away, ashamed to show his face, afraid of what others might say. All through the winter in his lonely clump of weed, till a flock of swans spied him there and very soon agreed, you're a very fine swan indeed.
A swan? Me a swan? Go on. He said, yes, you're a swan. Take a look at yourself in the lake and you'll see. And he looked and he saw and he said, I am a swan.
Whee! I'm not such an ugly duckling, no feathers all stubby and brown. For in fact these birds in so many words said, the best in town. The best, the best, the best in town. Not a quack, not a quack, not a waddle or a quack, but a glide and a whistle and a snowy wide back, and a head so noble and a heart. Say, who's an ugly duckling? Not I.
That was Danny Kaye's portrayal of Hans Christian Andersen from 1952. You don't have to be able to sing the song, or sing the story, I should say, but you get the point, right? Beautiful. It's important to help children accept loss and grief, pain. Today's show isn't to play psychologist. That's not my goal. It's about expression, the ultimate mission of So What's Your Story? Sometimes we avoid conversations with kids because the subject is uncomfortable for us. Well, forgive me if I'm butting in, but our comfort level is irrelevant. Our children should talk about topics, even if it's uncomfortable for everyone involved. Children deserve opportunities to share feelings and get the support they need. Only then can uncomfortable topics move a little bit toward the comfortable side of the continuum. Staying with Hans Christian Andersen, because no story speaks about a dying child's dream and hope better than The Little Match Girl. That was published in 1845. It was so terribly, terribly cold the last night of the year. It was snowing and so dark. And the little girl was afraid to go home, for she hasn't sold any matches. And she knew that her father would certainly beat her. Her mother never would have done that, but her mother was no longer here. As a matter of fact, she wore her mother's shoes, which she lost running to find shelter because they were so large. They were so big. So the little maiden walked on her tiny naked feet that were quite red and blue from the cold. She carried matches in an old apron, and she held a bundle of them in her hand. Nobody had thought anything of her whole livelong day. No one had ever thought about buying some matches to help her or her family. No one. No one. But she was so afraid to go home. She crept along, trembling with cold and hunger, a very picture of sorrow, the poor little thing, and the flakes of snow covered her long hair, which fell in beautiful curls around her neck. But of that, she still knew that she had to find shelter. In a corner formed by two houses, of which one advanced more than the other, she sat herself down and cowered herself, for she had nothing to cover her. Her little feet was drawn up near her. She had no shoes. She grew colder and colder. She couldn't go home. She was so, so afraid. It was so cold. Above the roof, she saw the wind was whistling, and she didn't know what to do. She thought maybe lighting a match could afford her a little bit of comfort. If only she dared to take a single match, she had to. So she drew the match. How it blazed, how it burned. It was a warm, bright flame like a candle. And she held her hands over it. It was a wonderful light. It seemed really brighter at the moment. And she looked on the wall between the homes, and she saw a large iron stove with burnished brass feet and a brass ornament atop. The fire burned with such influence, it warmed her so delightfully. And then, as the flame went out, so did the picture of the stove vanish. She rubbed another against the wall. Whack! Whack! Whatch! It was so hard to light that match, and it fell, and she lit another one. And then she saw a veil on the wall. There was a table spread with a large white tablecloth. Upon it was a splendid porcelain service. And the roast goose was there with all the stuffing and apples and dried plums. You know what happened? That goose came over and took her by the hand and sat her by the table and said, "Please join us." And then when the light went out, so did the beautiful table. She had to light another, and she did. Now she was sitting under the most magnificent Christmas tree. The flame had built a Christmas tree larger than she had ever seen. It was so beautifully decorated. It was as if it came from a rich merchant's house. The lights were so beautiful. And then it went out, just like the stove, just like the feast. And she looked up and she saw a shooting star. And she remembers that her grandmother, the person who loved her most in this life, told her that when that happens, someone is about to ascend to God, to go to heaven. Well, she was so cold, she drew another match against the wall. It was lighter than any others. The luster was unbelievable. And who did she see but her grandmother coming near her, closer to her? She suddenly lit all of the matches to make it as bright as possible. Now there were no matches left, but her grandmother was brighter and brighter than ever. And her grandmother took her by the hand and smiled and said, "Come with me. Come with me up high. We're going to go see Mama. We'll see God. It will no longer be cold, no hunger. You won't need a match. You'll just need love." The next morning, the townspeople saw the little girl, rosy cheeks and all, lying on the ground, dead, frozen to death. They just couldn't believe how sad that was. But they couldn't believe, although they'll never know, the wonderful night she spent, the last night of the year, and all of the beauties she saw that came with it. They'll never know. They'll never know. Always one of my favorite fairy tales. I'm afraid I didn't do a very good job at striking that match, but you got the idea. Imagine a fairy tale about a dying child, a child's voice, a magical night with shooting stars, a loving grandmother, all told through a lens of compassionate, tender expression. I've said many times on this show, expression isn't just important, it's everything. Now don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with a cool mix of soul. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to ever forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean we can't live happily ever after. Peace.
Time to holler down the pipe chase and rattle them bars.
The Prison Show airs Fridays 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT. For over 40 years, each two-hour program uses an hour to discuss issues and organizations of importance to prisoners and their families to help educate and inform our listeners. The second hour broadcasts shout-outs, live calls from inmates, family, and friends so inmates can hear their loved ones speaking on the air. For over 40 years, the show has connected Texas prison inmates with their friends and loved ones over the airwaves. You can't find an older Texas show, and it's right here on KPFT every Friday, 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT or online at kpft.org. Houston's Community Station.
Hey y'all, this is Susan, your host of Border Radio on Houston's community station, KPFT. Join us for Border Radio Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6, right after Deadbeat. Border Radio is your destination for music from your favorite independent artists and new artists on the rise. Mark your calendar, Border Radio Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6 on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, and kpft.org.
Some stations in Texas have lost their local announcers. Some cities even use a national music service to bring a limited variety of music to their communities and have lost that connection to their towns. Houston is lucky. KPFT is programmed by your neighbors, folks who live down the street from you, folks that you know. KPFT knows what's going on in the community and reflects performances that happen right here. Become a sustaining member today and keep KPFT local. Your donation at 713-526-5738 makes it all possible. Please call now. That number is 713-526-5738. Or if it's more convenient, use our website, kpft.org. And while you're there,
listening to